Chapter 19 Stepan Arkadyevitch was about to go away when Corney came in to announce, "Sergei Alexeyevich." "Who's Sergei Alexeyevich?" Stepan Arkadyevitch was about to say, but he remembered immediately. "Ah, Seryozha," he said aloud. "Sergei Alexeyevich. I thought it was the director of a department. Anna asked me to see him too," he thought. And he recalled the timid, piteous expression with which Anna had said to him at parting, "Anyway, you will see him. Find out exactly where he is, who's looking after him. And Stiva, if it were possible." Could it be possible? Stepan Arkadyevitch knew what was meant by that, "if it were possible." If it were possible to arrange the divorce so as to let her have her son. Stepan Arkadyevitch saw now that it was no good to dream of that. But still, he was glad to see his nephew. Alexei Alexandrovitch reminded his brother-in-law that they never spoke to the boy of his mother, and he begged him not to mention a single word about her. "He was very ill after that interview with his mother, which we had not foreseen," said Alexei Alexandrovitch. "Indeed, we feared for his life. But with sensible treatment and sea-bathing in the summer, he regained his strength, and now, on the doctor's advice, I've let him go to school. And certainly the companionship at school has had a good effect on him, and he's perfectly well and making good progress." "What a fine fellow he's grown!" "He's not little Seryozha now, but big Sergei Alexeyevich," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling as he looked at the handsome, broad-shouldered lad in blue coat and long trousers, who walked in alertly and confidently. The boy looked healthy and happy. He bowed to his uncle as to a stranger, but recognizing him, he blushed and turned hurriedly away from him, as though offended and irritated at something. The boy went up to his father and handed him his report card.
"Well, that's rather good," said his father. "You can go."
"He's thinner and taller and has grown from a child into a boy."
"I like that," said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "Do you remember me?"
The boy looked back quickly at his uncle. "Yes, mon oncle," he answered, glancing at his father, and again he looked downcast. His uncle called him to him, and took his hand.
"Well, and how are you getting on?" he said,
wanting to talk to him, and not knowing what to say. The boy, blushing and making no answer, cautiously drew his hand away. As soon as Stepan Arkadyevitch let go his hand, he glanced doubtfully at his father, and like a bird set free, darted out of the room. A year had passed since the last time Seryozha had seen his mother. Since then he had heard nothing more of her, and in the course of that year he had gone to school and made friends among his schoolmates. The dreams and memories of his mother, which had made him ill after seeing her, didn't occupy his thoughts now. When they came back to him, he studiously drove them away, regarding them as shameful and girlish, below the dignity of a boy and a schoolboy. He knew that his father and mother were separated by some quarrel. He knew that he had to remain with his father, and he tried to get used to that idea. He disliked seeing his uncle, so like his mother, for it called out those memories of which he was ashamed. He disliked it all the more, as from some words he had caught as he waited at the study door, and still more from the faces of his father and uncle, he guessed that they must have been talking of his mother. And to avoid condemning the father with whom he lived and on whom he was dependent, and above all, to avoid giving way to sentimentality which he considered so degrading, Seryozha tried not to look at his uncle who had come to disturb his peace of mind, and not to think of what he recalled to him. But when Stepan Arkadyevitch, going out after him, saw him on the stairs, and calling to him, asked him how he spent his playtime at school, Seryozha talked more freely to him away from his father's presence.
"We play railways now," he said in answer to his uncle's questions. "It's like this. Do you see? Two sit on a bench. They're the passengers. And one stands up straight on the belts. And they run through all the rooms. The doors are left open beforehand. Well, and it's pretty hard work being the conductor."
"That's the one that stands," Stepan Arkadyevitch inquired, smiling.
"Yes. You need courage, and must be quick, too, especially when they stop all of a sudden or someone falls down."
"Yes, that must be a serious matter,"
said Stepan Arkadyevitch, watching with mournful interest the eager eyes, like his mother's, not childish now, no longer fully innocent. And though he had promised Alexei Alexandrovitch not to speak of Anna, he couldn't restrain himself.
"Do you remember your mother?" he asked suddenly.
"No, I don't," Seryozha said quickly. He blushed crimson, and his face clouded over. And his uncle could get nothing more out of him. His tutor found his pupil on the staircase half an hour later, and for a long while he couldn't make out whether he was ill-tempered or crying.
"What is it? I expect you hurt yourself when you fell down," said the tutor. "I told you it was a dangerous game, and we shall have to speak to the director."
"If I had hurt myself, nobody would have found out, I assure you."
"Well, what is it, then?"
"Leave me alone. If I remember, or if I don't remember, what business is it of his? Why should I remember? Leave me in peace," he said, addressing not his tutor, but the whole world.
Chapter 20
Stepan Arkadyevitch, as usual, didn't waste his time in Petersburg. In Petersburg, besides business, his sister's divorce and his coveted appointment, he wanted, as he always did, to freshen himself up, as he said, after the mustiness of Moscow. In spite of its nightclubs and its omnibuses, Moscow was still a stagnant swamp. Stepan Arkadyevitch always felt it. After living for some time in Moscow, especially in close relations with his family, he was conscious of a depression of spirits. And after being there so long without a change, he reached a point when he positively began to be worrying himself over his wife's ill-humour and reproaches, over his children's health and education, and the petty details of his official work. Even the fact of being in debt worried him. But he had only to go and stay a little while in Petersburg, in the circle there in which he moved, where people lived, really lived, instead of vegetating as in Moscow, and all such ideas vanished and melted away at once, like wax before the fire. His wife? Only that day he'd been talking to Prince Tchetchensky. Prince Tchetchensky had a wife and family, grown-up pages in the corps, and he had an illegitimate family of children also. Though the first family was very nice, Prince Tchetchensky felt happier in his second family, and he used to take his eldest son with him to his second family, and told Stepan Arkadyevitch that he thought it good for his son, broadening his ideas. What would have been said to that in Moscow? His children. In Petersburg, children didn't prevent their parents from enjoying life. The children were brought up in boarding schools, and there was no trace of the wild notions that prevailed in Moscow. In Lvov's household, for instance, that all luxuries of life were for the children, while the parents were to have nothing but work and anxiety. Here people understood that a man is in duty bound to live for himself, as every man of culture should live. The service. Here it was not the stiff, hopeless drudgery that it was in Moscow. Here there was some interest in official life. A chance meeting, a service rendered, a happy phrase, a knack of facetious mimicry, and in a flash a man's career might be made. So it had been with Bryantsev, whom Stepan Arkadyevitch had met the previous day, and who was one of the highest functionaries in government now. There was some interest in official work like that. The Petersburg attitude on pecuniary matters had an especially soothing effect on Stepan Arkadyevitch. Bartnyansky, who spent at least 50,000, to judge by the style in which he lived, had made an interesting comment the day before on that subject. As they were talking before dinner, Stepan Arkadyevitch said to Bartnyansky, "You're friendly, I think, with Mordvinsky. You might do me a favour. Say a word to him, please, for me. There's an appointment I would like to get. The secretary of the agency." "Oh, I shan't remember all that if you tell it to me. But what possesses you to get mixed up with railways and Jews? Any way you look at it, it's a stinking business."
Stepan Arkadyevitch didn't say to Bartnyansky that it was a growing business. Bartnyansky wouldn't have understood that.
"I want the money. I've nothing to live on."
"You're living, aren't you?"
"Yes, but in debt."
"Are you really? Heavily?" said Bartnyansky sympathetically.
"Very heavily. 20,000.
Bartnyansky broke into good-humoured laughter.
"Oh, lucky fellow," said he.
My debts mount up to 1.5 million, and I've nothing, and still I can live, as you see."
And Stepan Arkadyevitch saw the truth of this view, not in words only, but in actual fact. Zhivakov owed 300,000, and hadn't a kopeck to bless himself with, and he lived, and in style, too. Count Krivtsov was considered a hopeless case by everyone, and yet he kept 2 mistresses. Petrovsky had run through 5 million, and still lived in just the same style, and was even a manager in the financial department with a salary of 20,000. But besides this, Petersburg had physically a pleasant effect on Stepan Arkadyevitch. It made him younger. In Moscow he sometimes found a grey hair in his head, dropped asleep after dinner, stretched, walked slowly upstairs, breathing heavily, was bored by the society of young women, and didn't dance at balls. In Petersburg he always felt 10 years younger. His experience in Petersburg was exactly what had been described to him on the previous day by Prince Pyotr Oblonsky, a man of 60 who'd just come back from abroad.
"We don't know the way to live here," said Pyotr Oblonsky. "I spent the summer in Baden, and you wouldn't believe it. I felt quite a young man. At a glimpse of a pretty woman, my thoughts... Well, one dines and drinks a glass of wine and feels strong and ready for anything. I came home to Russia, had to see my wife, and what's more, go to my country place, and there, you'd hardly believe it, in 2 weeks I'd got into a dressing gown and given up dressing for dinner. Needless to say, I had no thoughts left for pretty women. I became quite an old gentleman. There was nothing left for me but to think of my eternal salvation. I went off to Paris. I was as right as could be at once."
Stepan Arkadyevitch felt exactly the difference that Pyotr Oblonsky described. In Moscow, he degenerated so much that if he had had to be there much longer, he might in earnest have come to considering his salvation. In Petersburg, he felt himself a man of the world again. Between Princess Betsy Tverskaya and Stepan Arkadyevitch, there had long existed rather curious relations. Stepan Arkadyevitch always flirted with her in jest, and used to say to her, also in jest, the most improper things, knowing that nothing delighted her so much. The day after his conversation with Karenin, Stepan Arkadyevitch went to see her, and felt so youthful that in this jesting flirtation and nonsense, he recklessly went so far that he didn't know how to extricate himself, as unfortunately he was so far from being attracted by her that he thought her positively repulsive. What made it hard to change the conversation was the fact that he was very attractive to her, so that he was considerably relieved at the arrival of Princess Miyakaya, which cut short their tête-à-tête.
"Ah, so you're here," she said when she saw him. "Well, and what news of your poor sister? You needn't look at me like that," she added. "Ever since they've all turned against her, all those who are 1,000 times worse than she, I've thought she did a very fine thing. I can't forgive Vronsky for not letting me know when she was in Petersburg. I'd have gone to see her, and gone about with her everywhere. Please give her my love. Come, tell me about her."
"Yes, her position is very difficult. She..."
Stepan Arkadyevitch began, in the simplicity of his heart, accepting her words at face value.
"Tell me about her,"
Princess Miyakaya interrupted him immediately, as she always did, and began talking herself.
"She's done what they all do, except me. Only they hide it. But she wouldn't be deceitful, and she did a fine thing. And she did better still in throwing up that crazy brother-in-law of yours. You must excuse me. Everybody used to say he was so clever, so very clever. I was the only one who said he was a fool. Now that he's so thick with Lydia Ivanovna and Lando, they all say he's crazy, and I would prefer not to agree with everybody. This time I can't help it."
"Oh, do please explain," said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "What does it mean?"
"Yesterday I saw him on my sister's behalf, and I asked him to give me a final answer. He gave me no answer, and said he would think it over. But this morning, instead of an answer, I received an invitation from Countess Lydia Ivanovna for this evening." "Ah, so that's it. That's it," said Princess Miyakaya gleefully. "They're going to ask Lando what he's to say."
"Ask Lando? What for?
Who or what's Lando?"
"What? You don't know Jules Lando? The famous Jules Lando, the clairvoyant?"
He's crazy, too. But on him, your sister's fate depends. See what comes of living in the provinces. You know nothing about anything. Lando, you see, was a shop assistant in Paris. And he went to a doctor's, and in the doctor's waiting room he fell asleep. And in his sleep he began giving advice to all the patients. And wonderful advice it was. Then the wife of Yuri Melodinsky, you know, the invalid, heard of this Lando, and had him see her husband. And he cured her husband. Though I can't say that I see he did him much good, for he's just as feeble a creature as he ever was. But they believed in him, and took him along with them, and brought him to Russia. Here there's been a general rush to him, and he's begun doctoring everyone. He cured Countess Beelzubova, and she took such a fancy to him that she adopted him. Adopted him? Yes, as her son. He's not Lando any more now, but Count Beelzubov. That's neither here nor there, though. But Lydia, I'm very fond of her, but she has a screw loose somewhere, has lost her heart to this Lando now, and nothing is settled in her house or Alexei Alexandrovitch's without him. And so your sister's fate is now in the hands of Lando, alias Count Beelzubov.
Chapter 21. After an excellent dinner, and a great deal of cognac drunk at Bartnyansky's, Stepan Arkadyevitch, only a little later than the appointed time, went in to Countess Lydia Ivanovna's.
"Who else is with the Countess? A Frenchman?" Stepan Arkadyevitch asked the hall porter, as he glanced at the familiar overcoat of Alexei Alexandrovitch, and a strange, rather artless-looking overcoat with clasps.
"Alexei Alexandrovitch Karenin and Count Beelzubov," the porter answered severely.
"Princess Miakaya guessed right," thought Stepan Arkadyevitch as he went upstairs. "Curious. It would be quite as well, though, to get on friendly terms with her. She has immense influence. If she would say a word to Pomorsky, the thing would be a certainty."
It was still quite light outside, but in Countess Lydia Ivanovna's little drawing-room the blinds were drawn and the lamps lighted. At a round table, under a lamp, sat the Countess and Alexei Alexandrovitch, talking softly. A short, thinnish man, very pale and handsome, with feminine hips, knock-kneed, with fine, brilliant eyes, and long hair lying on the collar of his coat, was standing at the other end of the room, gazing at the portraits on the wall. After greeting the lady of the house and Alexei Alexandrovitch, Stepan Arkadyevitch couldn't resist glancing once more at the unknown man.
"Monsieur Lando," the Countess addressed him with a softness and caution that impressed Oblonsky, and she introduced them.
Lando looked around hurriedly, came up, and, smiling, laid his moist, lifeless hand in Stepan Arkadyevitch's outstretched hand, and immediately walked away and began gazing at the portraits again. The Countess and Alexei Alexandrovitch looked at each other meaningfully.
"I'm very glad to see you particularly today," said Countess Lydia Ivanovna, pointing Stepan Arkadyevitch to a seat beside Karenin. "I introduced you to him as Lando," she said in a soft voice, glancing at the Frenchman, and again immediately after at Alexei Alexandrovitch. "But he's really Count Beelzubov, as you're probably aware, only he doesn't like the title."
"Yes, I heard so," answered Stepan Arkadyevitch.
"They say he completely cured Countess Beelzubova." "She was here today, poor thing," the Countess said, turning to Alexei Alexandrovitch. "This separation is awful for her. It's such a blow to her."
"And he's definitely going?" queried Alexei Alexandrovitch.
"Yes, he's going to Paris."
"He heard a voice yesterday," said Countess Lydia Ivanovna, looking at Stepan Arkadyevitch.
"Ah, the voice," repeated Oblonsky, feeling that he must be as circumspect as he possibly could in this society, where something peculiar was going on, or was to go on, to which he hadn't the key.
A moment's silence followed, after which Countess Lydia Ivanovna, as though approaching the main topic of conversation, said with a fine smile to Oblonsky,
"I've known you for a long while, and am very glad to make a closer acquaintance with you. Les amis de nos amis sont nos amis.
But to be a true friend, one must enter into the spiritual state of one's friend. And I fear that you are not doing so in the case of Alexei Alexandrovitch. You understand what I mean, she said, lifting her fine, pensive eyes.
In part, Countess, I understand the position of Alexei Alexandrovitch, said Oblonsky.
Having no clear idea what they were talking about, he wanted to confine himself to generalities.
The change is not in his external position, Countess Lydia Ivanovna said sternly, following with eyes of love the figure of Alexei Alexandrovitch as he got up and crossed over to Lando. His heart is changed. A new heart has been vouchsafed him, and I fear you don't fully apprehend the change that has taken place in him.
Oh, well, in a general way I can conceive the change. We've always been friendly, and now, said Stepan Arkadyevitch,
responding with a sympathetic glance to the expression of the Countess, and mentally balancing the question which of the two ministers she was closer to, so as to know which one he should ask her to influence.
The change that has taken place in him cannot lessen his love for his neighbours. On the contrary, that change can only intensify love in his heart.
But I'm afraid you do not understand me. Won't you have some tea? She said, with her eyes indicating the footman who was handing round tea on a tray.
Not altogether, Countess. Of course his misfortune.
Yes, a misfortune which has proved the highest happiness when his heart was made new, was filled full of it, she said, gazing with eyes full of love at Stepan Arkadyevitch.
I do believe I might ask her to speak to both of them, thought Stepan Arkadyevitch. Oh, of course, Countess, he said. But I imagine such changes are a matter so private that no one, even the most intimate friend, would care to speak of them.
On the contrary, we ought to speak freely and help one another.
Yes, undoubtedly so, but there is such a difference of convictions, and besides, said Oblonsky with a soft smile, there can be no difference where it is a question of holy truth. Oh, no, of course, but...
And Stepan Arkadyevitch paused in confusion. He understood at last that they were talking of religion.
"I think he will fall asleep immediately," said Alexei Alexandrovitch in a whisper full of meaning, going up to Lydia Ivanovna.
Stepan Arkadyevitch looked around. Lando was sitting at the window, leaning on his elbow and the back of his chair, his head drooping. Noticing that all eyes were turned on him, he raised his head and smiled a smile of childlike artlessness.
"Don't take any notice," said Lydia Ivanovna,
and she lightly moved a chair up for Alexei Alexandrovitch.
"I have observed," she was beginning,
when a footman came into the room with a letter. Lydia Ivanovna rapidly ran her eyes over the note, and, excusing herself, wrote an answer with extraordinary rapidity, handed it to the man, and came back to the table.
"I have observed," she went on, "that Moscow people, especially the men, are more indifferent to religion than anyone." "Oh, no, Countess. I thought Moscow people had the reputation of being the firmest in the faith," answered Stepan Arkadyevitch. "But as far as I can make out, you are unfortunately one of the indifferent ones," said Alexei Alexandrovitch, turning to him with a weary smile.
"How anyone can be indifferent," said Lydia Ivanovna.
"I am not so much indifferent on that subject as I am waiting in suspense," said Stepan Arkadyevitch with his most deprecating smile. "I hardly think that the time for such questions has come yet for me."
Alexei Alexandrovitch and Lydia Ivanovna looked at each other.
"We can never tell whether the time has come for us or not," said Alexei Alexandrovitch severely. "We ought not to think whether we are ready or not ready. God's grace is not guided by human considerations. Sometimes it comes not to those that strive for it, but to those that are unprepared, like Saul."
"No, I believe it won't be just yet," said Lydia Ivanovna,
who had been meanwhile watching the movements of the Frenchman. Lando got up and went over to them.
"Am I allowed to listen?" he asked.
"Oh, yes, I didn't want to disturb you," said Lydia Ivanovna, gazing tenderly at him. "Sit here with us." One has only not to close one's eyes to shut out the light,
Alexei Alexandrovitch went on.
Ah, if you knew the happiness we know, feeling his presence ever in our hearts, said Countess Lydia Ivanovna with a rapturous smile.
But a man may feel himself unworthy sometimes to rise to that height, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, conscious of hypocrisy in admitting this religious height,
but at the same time unable to bring himself to acknowledge his free-thinking views before a person who, by a single word to Pomorsky, might procure him the coveted appointment.
That is, you mean that sin keeps him back, said Lydia Ivanovna.
That is a false notion. There is no sin for believers. Their sin has been atoned for.
Pardon, she added, looking at the footman who came in again with another letter. She read it, and gave a verbal answer.
Tomorrow at the Grand Duchess's, say. For the believer, sin is not, she went on.
Yes, but faith without works is dead, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, recalling the phrase from the catechism, and only by his smile clinging to his independence.
There you have it, from the Epistle of St. James, said Alexei Alexandrovitch,
addressing Lydia Ivanovna with a certain reproachfulness in his tone. It was unmistakably a subject they had discussed more than once before.
What harm has been done by the false interpretation of that passage? Nothing holds men back from belief like that misinterpretation. I have no works, so I cannot believe.
Yet that is not said anywhere. It's just the opposite.
Striving for God, saving the soul by fasting, said Countess Lydia Ivanovna, with absolute contempt. Those are the crude ideas of our monks. Yet that is nowhere said.
It is far simpler and easier, she added, looking at Oblonsky with the same encouraging smile with which at court she encouraged youthful maids of honour, disconcerted by the new surroundings of the court.
We are saved by Christ who suffered for us. We are saved by faith, Alexei Alexandrovitch chimed in, with a glance of approval at her words.
Vous comprenez l'anglais?
Asked Lydia Ivanovna, and receiving a reply in the affirmative, she got up and began looking through a shelf of books.
I want to read him Safe and Happy, or Under the Wing, she said, looking inquiringly at Karenin.
And finding the book, and sitting down again in her place, she opened it.
It's very short. In it is described the way by which faith can be reached, and the happiness, above all earthly bliss, with which it fills the soul. The believer cannot be unhappy, because he is not alone. But you'll see.
She was just settling herself to read when the footman came in again.
Madame Borodzina, tell her tomorrow at 2 o'clock.
Yes, she said, putting her finger in the place in the book, and gazing before her with her fine, pensive eyes.
That is how true faith acts. You know Maria Sanina? You know about her trouble.
She lost her only child. She was in despair.
And what happened? She found this comforter, and she thanks God now for the death of her child. Such is the happiness faith brings.
Oh, yes, that is most,
said Stepan Arkadyevitch, glad they were going to read and let him have a chance to collect his faculties.
No, I see I'd better not ask her about anything today, he thought. If only I can get out of this without putting my foot in it.
It will be boring for you, said Countess Lydia Ivanovna, addressing Lando. You don't know English, but it's short.
Oh, I shall understand, said Lando with the same smile,
and he closed his eyes. Alexei Alexandrovitch and Lydia Ivanovna exchanged meaningful glances, and the reading began. Chapter 22 Stepan Arkadyevitch felt completely baffled by the strange talk that he was hearing for the first time. The complexity of Petersburg, as a rule, had a stimulating effect on him, rousing him out of his Moscow stagnation. He liked complications, but understood them only in the circles he knew and was at home in. In these unfamiliar surroundings, he was puzzled and disconcerted, and couldn't get his bearings. As he listened to Countess Lydia Ivanovna, aware of the beautiful, artless, or perhaps artful, he couldn't decide which, eyes of Lando fixed upon him, Stepan Arkadyevitch began to be conscious of a peculiar heaviness in his head. The most incongruous ideas were running through his mind.
Maria Sanina is glad her child's dead. How good a smoke would be now. To be saved, one need only believe. And the monks don't know how the thing's to be done, but Countess Lydia Ivanovna does know. And why is my head so heavy? Is it the cognac, or all this being so strange? Anyway, I think I've done nothing objectionable so far. But even so, it won't do to ask her now. They say they make one say one's prayers. I only hope they won't make me. That'll be too absurd. And what nonsense she's reading. But she has a good accent. Lando. Beelzebub. What's he Beelzebub for?
All at once, Stepan Arkadyevitch became aware that his lower jaw was uncontrollably forming a yawn. He smoothed his whiskers to mask the yawn and shook himself. But soon after, he became aware that he was falling asleep and on the very point of snoring. He recovered himself at the very moment when the voice of Countess Lydia Ivanovna was saying, "He's asleep." Stepan Arkadyevitch started with dismay, feeling guilty and caught. But he was reassured at once by seeing that they were referring not to him, but to Lando. The Frenchman, as well as Stepan Arkadyevitch, was asleep. But Stepan Arkadyevitch's being asleep would have offended them, he thought, though even this might not be so, as everything seemed so strange, while Lando's being asleep delighted them very much, especially Countess Lydia Ivanovna.
"Mon ami,"
said Lydia Ivanovna, carefully holding the folds of her silk dress so as not to rustle, and in her excitement calling Karenin not Alexei Alexandrovitch, but "mon ami."
"Give me your hand. You see?
Shh!" she hissed at the footman as he came in again.
"Not at home."
The Frenchman was asleep, or pretending to be asleep, with his head on the back of his chair, and his moist hand, as it lay on his knee, made faint movements as though trying to catch something. Alexei Alexandrovitch got up, tried to move carefully, but stumbled against the table, went up, and laid his hand in the Frenchman's hand. Stepan Arkadyevitch got up too, and opening his eyes wide, trying to force himself awake, he looked first at one and then at the other. It was all real. Stepan Arkadyevitch felt that his head was getting worse and worse.
"Let the person who came in last, the one who questions, go out. Let him go out," articulated the Frenchman without opening his eyes.
"You must excuse me, but you see, come back at 10, or better still, tomorrow."
"Let him go out,"
repeated the Frenchman impatiently.
"It's me, isn't it?"
And receiving an answer in the affirmative, Stepan Arkadyevitch, forgetting the favour he had meant to ask of Lydia Ivanovna, and forgetting his sister's affairs, caring for nothing, but filled with the sole desire to get away as soon as possible, went out on tiptoe and ran out into the street as though from a plague-stricken house. For a long while he chatted and joked with his cab driver, trying to regain his senses as quickly as possible. At the French Theatre, where he arrived for the last act, and afterwards at the Tartar restaurant after his champagne, Stepan Arkadyevitch felt a little refreshed in the atmosphere he was used to. But still, he felt quite unlike himself all that evening. On getting home to Pyotr Oblonsky's, where he was staying, Stepan Arkadyevitch found a note from Betsy. She wrote that she was very anxious to finish their interrupted conversation, and begged him to come the next day. He had scarcely read this note and frowned at its contents when he heard below the ponderous tramp of the servants carrying something heavy. Stepan Arkadyevitch went out to look. It was the rejuvenated Pyotr Oblonsky. He was so drunk that he couldn't walk upstairs, but he told them to set him on his legs when he saw Stepan Arkadyevitch, and clinging to him, he walked with him into his room and there began telling him how he had spent the evening and fell asleep doing so. Stepan Arkadyevitch was in very low spirits, which happened rarely with him, and for a long while he couldn't go to sleep. Everything he could recall to his mind, everything was disgusting, but most disgusting of all, as if it were something shameful, was the memory of the evening he had spent at Countess Lydia Ivanovna's. The next day he received from Alexei Alexandrovitch a final answer, refusing to grant Anna's divorce, and he understood that this decision was based on what the Frenchman had said in his real or pretended trance the evening before. Chapter 23. In order to carry through any undertaking in family life, there must necessarily be either complete division between the husband and wife, or loving agreement. When the relations of a couple are vacillating, and neither one thing nor the other, no sort of enterprise can be undertaken. Many families remain for years in the same place, though both husband and wife are sick of it, simply because there is neither complete division nor agreement between them. Both Vronsky and Anna felt life in Moscow unbearable in the heat and dust, when the spring sunshine was followed by the glare of summer, and all the trees in the boulevards had long since been in full leaf, and the leaves were covered with dust. But they didn't go back to Vodvizhenskoye, as they had arranged to do long before. They continued their stay in Moscow, though they both loathed it, because of late there had been no agreement between them. The irritability that kept them apart had no external cause, and all efforts to come to an understanding intensified it instead of removing it. It was an inner irritation, grounded in her mind on the conviction that his love had diminished, in his, on regret that he had put himself for her sake in a difficult position, which she, instead of lightening, made still more difficult. Neither of them gave full utterance to their sense of grievance, but they considered each other in the wrong and tried on every pretext to prove this to one another. In her eyes, the whole of him, with all his habits, ideas, desires, with all his spiritual and physical temperament, was one thing, love for women. And that love, she felt, ought to be entirely concentrated on her alone. Yet that love was diminishing. Consequently, as she reasoned, he must have transferred part of his love to other women, or to another woman, and she was jealous. She was jealous not of any particular woman, but of the decrease of his love. Not having an object for her jealousy, she was on the lookout for it. At the slightest hint, she transferred her jealousy from one object to another. At one time she was jealous of those coarse women with whom he might so easily renew his old bachelor ties. Then she was jealous of the society woman he might meet. Then she was jealous of the imaginary girl whom he might want to marry, for whose sake he would break with her. And this last form of jealousy tortured her most of all, especially as he had unwarily told her, in a moment of frankness, that his mother knew him so little that she had had the audacity to try and persuade him to marry the young Princess Sorokina. And being jealous of him, Anna was indignant against him, and found grounds for indignation in everything. For everything that was difficult in her position, she blamed him. The agonizing suspense she had suffered at Moscow, the tardiness and indecision of Alexei Alexandrovitch, her solitude, she put it all down to him. If he had loved her, he would have seen all the bitterness of her position, and would have rescued her from it. For her, being in Moscow, and not in the country, he was to blame too. He couldn't live buried in the country as she would have liked to do. He had to have society, and he had put her in this awful position, the bitterness of which he wouldn't see. Again, it was his fault that she was forever separated from her son. Even the rare moments of tenderness that came from time to time didn't soothe her. In his tenderness now, she saw a shade of complacency, of self-confidence, which had not been of old, and which exasperated her. It was dusk. Anna was alone and waiting for him to come back from a bachelor dinner. She walked up and down in his study, the room where the noise from the street was least heard, and thought over every detail of yesterday's quarrel. Going back from the well-remembered offensive words of the quarrel to what had been the reason for it, she arrived at last at its origin. For a long while she could hardly believe that their dissension had arisen from a conversation so inoffensive, of so little moment to either. But so it actually had been. It all arose from his laughing at the girls' high schools, declaring they were useless, while she defended them. He had spoken deprecatingly of women's education in general, and had said that Hannah, Anna's English protégé, had not the slightest need to know anything of physics. This irritated Anna. She saw in this a contemptuous reference to her occupations,
and she thought of something that would pay him back for the pain he had given her. I don't expect you to understand me, my feelings, as anyone who loved me might, but simple delicacy I did expect, she said. And he had actually flushed with vexation, and had said something unpleasant. She couldn't recall her answer, but at that point, with an unmistakable desire to hurt her too, he had said,
I feel no interest in your infatuation over this girl, because I see it's unnatural.
The cruelty with which he shattered the world she had built up for herself so laboriously to enable her to endure her hard life, the injustice with which he had accused her of affectation, of artificiality, aroused her. I'm very sorry that nothing but what's coarse and material is comprehensible and natural to you, she said, and walked out of the room. When he had come to her yesterday evening, they hadn't referred to the quarrel. Both felt that the quarrel had been smoothed over, but was not at an end. Today he hadn't been at home all day, and she felt so lonely and wretched in being on bad terms with him that she wanted to forget it all, to forgive him, and to be reconciled with him. She wanted to throw the blame on herself and to justify him. I myself am to blame. I'm irritable. I'm insanely jealous. I'll make it up with him, and we'll go away to the country. There I shall be more at peace. Unnatural. She suddenly recalled the word that had stung her most of all. Not so much the word itself as the intent to hurt her with which it was said. I know what he meant. He meant unnatural, not loving my own daughter, to love another person's child. What does he know of love for children? Of my love for Seryozha, whom I've sacrificed for him? But that wish to hurt me. No, he loves another woman. It must be so. And perceiving that while trying to regain her peace of mind, she had gone round the same circle that she had been round so often before, and had come back to her former state of exasperation, she was horrified at herself. Can it be impossible? Can it be beyond me to control myself? She said to herself, and began again from the beginning. He's truthful, he's honest, he loves me. I love him, and in a few days the divorce will come. What more do I want? I want peace of mind and trust, and I will take the blame on myself. Yes, now, when he comes in, I'll tell him I was wrong, though I was not wrong, and we'll go away tomorrow. And to escape thinking any more and being overcome by irritability, she rang and ordered the trunks to be brought for packing their things for the country. At 10 o'clock, Vronsky came in. Chapter 24. Well, was it nice? She asked, coming out to meet him with a penitent and meek expression.
Just as usual, he answered,
seeing at a glance that she was in one of her good moods. He was used by now to these transitions, and he was particularly glad to see it today, as he was in especially good humour himself.
What do I see? Ah, that's right, he said, pointing to the trunks in the passage.
Yes, we must go. I went out for a drive, and it was so fine, I long to be in the country. There's nothing to keep you, is there?
It's the one thing I desire. I'll be back in a moment, and we'll talk it over. I only want to change. Order some tea.
And he went into his room. There was something mortifying in the way he had said,
Ah, that's right,
as one says to a child when it stops being naughty. And still more mortifying was the contrast between her penitent and his self-confident tone. And for one instant, she felt the desire for a fight rising up in her again. But making an effort, she conquered it, and met Vronsky as good-humouredly as before. When he came in, she told him, partly repeating phrases she had prepared beforehand, how she had spent the day and her plans for going away. You know, it came to me almost like an inspiration, she said. Why wait here for the divorce? Won't it just be the same in the country? I can't wait any longer. I don't want to go on hoping. I don't want to hear anything about the divorce. I've made up my mind it shall not have any more influence on my life. Do you agree?
Oh, yes, he said,
glancing uneasily at her excited face.
"What did you do? Who was there?" she said, after a pause.
Vronsky mentioned the names of the guests.
"The dinner was first-rate, and the boat race, and it was all pleasant enough. But in Moscow they can never do anything without something ridiculous. Some woman turned up, teacher of swimming to the Queen of Sweden, and gave us an exhibition of her skill."
"How? Did she swim?"
asked Anna, frowning.
"In an absurd red bathing suit. She was old and hideous, too. So, when shall we go?"
"What an absurd idea. Why, did she swim in some special way, then?"
said Anna, not answering.
"There was absolutely nothing in it. That's just what I'm saying. It was awfully stupid. Well, then, when do you think of going?"
Anna shook her head as though trying to drive away some unpleasant idea.
"When? Why, the sooner the better. By tomorrow we can't be ready. The day after tomorrow."
"Yes." "Oh, no, wait a minute. The day after tomorrow, Sunday, I have to see Maman," said Vronsky, embarrassed, because as soon as he uttered his mother's name, he was aware of her intent, suspicious eyes.
His embarrassment confirmed her suspicion. She flushed hotly and drew away from him. It was now not the Queen of Sweden's swimming instructor who filled Anna's imagination, but the young Princess Sorokina. She was staying in a village near Moscow with Countess Vronskaya.
"Can't you go tomorrow?" she said.
"Well, no. The power of attorney and money for the business I'm going there for, I can't get by tomorrow," he answered.
"If so, we won't go at all."
"But why not?"
"I shall not go later, Monday or never."
"Why?" said Vronsky, looking shocked.
"Why? There's no sense in it." "There's no sense in it to you because you care nothing for me.
You don't care to understand my life. The one thing that I cared for here was Hannah. You say it's affectation.
Why, you said yesterday that I don't love my daughter, that I love this English girl, that it's unnatural. I should like to know what life there is for me that could be natural."
For an instant she had a clear vision of what she was doing, and was horrified at how she had fallen away from her resolution. But even though she knew it was her own ruin, she couldn't restrain herself, couldn't keep herself from proving to him that he was wrong, couldn't give way to him.
"I never said that. I said I didn't sympathize with this sudden passion."
"How is it, though you boast of your straightforwardness, you don't tell the truth?"
"I never boast, and I never tell lies," he said slowly, restraining his rising anger. "It's a great pity if you can't respect—"
"Respect was invented to cover the empty place where love should be.
And if you don't love me any more, it would be better and more honest to say so." "No, this is becoming unbearable," cried Vronsky, getting up from his chair, and stopping short, facing her, he said, speaking deliberately, "Why do you try my patience?" Looking as though he might have said much more, but was restraining himself. "It has limits."
"What do you mean by that?"
she cried, looking with terror at the undisguised hatred in his whole face, and especially in his cruel, menacing eyes.
"I mean to say—" he was beginning,
but he checked himself.
"I must ask what it is you want of me."
"What can I want?
All I can want is that you shouldn't desert me, as you think of doing," she said, understanding all he had not uttered. "But that I don't want. That's secondary. I want love, and there is none. So then all is over."
She turned toward the door.
"Wait, wait," said Vronsky, with no change in the gloomy lines of his brows, though he held her by the hand.
"What is it all about?"
"I said that we must put off going for 3 days. And on that you told me I was lying, that I was not an honourable man."
"Yes, and I repeat that the man who reproaches me with having sacrificed everything for me," she said, recalling the words of a still earlier quarrel, "that he's worse than a dishonourable man. He's a heartless man."
"Oh, there are limits to endurance," he cried,
and hastily let go of her hand. "He hates me, that's clear," she thought. And in silence, without looking around, she walked with faltering steps out of the room. "He loves another woman, that's even clearer," she said to herself as she went into her own room. "I want love, and there is none. So then, all is over." She repeated the words she had said. "And it must be ended." But how? She asked herself, and she sat down in a low chair before the mirror. Thoughts of where she would go now, whether to the aunt who had brought her up, to Dolly, or simply alone abroad, and of what he was doing now alone in his study, whether this was the final quarrel, or whether reconciliation was still possible, and of what all her old friends at Petersburg would say of her now, and of how Alexei Alexandrovitch would look at it, and many other ideas of what would happen now after the break came into her head, but she didn't give herself up to them with all her heart. At the bottom of her heart was some obscure idea that alone interested her, but she couldn't get clear sight of it. Thinking once more of Alexei Alexandrovitch, she recalled the time of her illness after her confinement, and the feeling which never left her at that time. "Why didn't I die?" And the words and the feeling of that time came back to her, and all at once she knew what was in her soul. Yes, it was the idea which alone solved all. Yes, to die. And the shame and disgrace of Alexei Alexandrovitch and of Seryozha, and my terrible shame, it would all be saved by death. To die. And he will feel remorse, will be sorry, will love me. He will suffer on my account. With the trace of a smile of self-pity for herself, she sat down in the armchair, taking off and putting on the rings on her left hand, vividly picturing from different sides his feelings after her death. Approaching footsteps, his steps, distracted her attention. As though absorbed in the arrangement of her rings, she didn't even turn to him. He went up to her, and taking her by the hand, he said softly, "Anna, we'll go the day after tomorrow, if you like. I agree to everything." She didn't speak. "What is it?" he urged. "You know," she said, and at the same instant, unable to restrain herself any longer, she burst into sobs. "Abandon me, abandon me," she articulated between her sobs. "I'll go away tomorrow. I'll do more. What am I? An immoral woman, a stone around your neck. I don't want to make you wretched. I don't want to. I'll set you free. You don't love me. You love someone else." Vronsky besought her to be calm, and declared that there was not the slightest foundation for her jealousy, that he had never ceased and would never cease to love her, that he loved her more than ever. "Anna, why distress yourself and me so?" he said to her, kissing her hands. There was tenderness now in his face, and she thought she caught the sound of tears in his voice, and she felt them wet on her hand. And instantly Anna's despairing jealousy changed to a despairing passion of tenderness. She put her arms around him, and covered with kisses his head, his neck, his hands. Chapter 25. Feeling that the reconciliation was complete, Anna eagerly set to work in the morning, preparing for their departure. Though it wasn't settled whether they should go on Monday or Tuesday, as they had each given way to the other, Anna packed busily, feeling absolutely indifferent whether they went a day earlier or later. She was standing in her room, over an open trunk, taking things out of it, when he came in to see her earlier than usual, dressed to go out.
"I'm going off at once to see Maman. She can send me the money by Yegorov, and I shall be ready to go tomorrow," he said. Though she was in such a good mood, the thought of his visit to his mother's stung her.
"No, I shan't be ready by then myself," she said, and at once reflected, "so that it was possible to arrange to do as I wished."
"No, do as you meant to do. Go into the dining room. I'll come just as soon as I've sorted out these things that aren't needed," she said,
putting something more on the heap of frippery that lay in Anushka's arms. Vronsky was eating his beefsteak when she came into the dining room.
"You wouldn't believe how distasteful these rooms have become to me," she said, sitting down beside him to her coffee. "There's nothing more awful than these chambres garnies. There's no individuality in them, no soul. These clocks and curtains, and worst of all, the wallpaper. They're a nightmare. I think of Vodvizhenskoye as the promised land.
You're not sending the horses off yet?"
"No. They'll come after us. Where are you going?"
"I wanted to go to Wilson's to take some dresses to her. So it's really to be tomorrow?" she said in a cheerful voice. But suddenly her face changed.
Vronsky's valet came in to ask him to sign a receipt for a telegram from Petersburg. There was nothing unusual in Vronsky's getting a telegram, but he said, as though anxious to conceal something from her, that the receipt was in his study, and he turned hurriedly to her.
"By tomorrow, without fail, I'll finish it all."
"From whom is the telegram?" she asked, not hearing him.
"From Stiva," he answered reluctantly.
"Why didn't you show it to me? What secret can there be between Stiva and you?"
Vronsky called the valet back and told him to bring the telegram.
"I didn't want to show it to you because Stiva has such a passion for telegraphing. Why telegraph when nothing is settled?"
"About the divorce?"
"Yes. But he says he's not been able to arrive at anything yet. He's promised a decisive answer in a day or two. But here it is. Read it."
With trembling hands, Anna took the telegram and read what Vronsky had told her. At the end was added, "Little hope, but I will do everything possible and impossible." "I said yesterday that it's absolutely nothing to me when I get, or whether I never get, a divorce," she said, flushing crimson. "There was not the slightest necessity to hide it from me." "So he may hide, and does hide, his correspondence with women from me," she thought.
"Yashvin meant to come this morning with Voitov," said Vronsky.
"I believe he's won from Pestsov all and more than he can pay. About 60,000.
"No," she said,
irritated by his so obviously showing by this change of subject that he was irritated.
"Why did you suppose that this news would affect me so, that you must even try to hide it? I said I don't want to consider it, and I would have liked you to care as little about it as I do."
"I care about it because I like definiteness," he said.
"Definiteness is not in the form, but the love," she said,
more and more irritated, not by his words, but by the tone of cool composure in which he spoke.
"What do you want it for?"
"My God, love again," he thought, frowning. "Oh, you know what for. For your sake and your children's in the future."
"There won't be children in the future."
"That's a great pity," he said.
"You want it for the children's sake, but you don't think of me," she said, quite forgetting, or not having heard, that he had said, "for your sake and the children's."
The question of the possibility of having children had long been a subject of dispute and irritation to her. His desire to have children she interpreted as a proof he didn't prize her beauty.
"Oh, I said for your sake."
"Above all, for your sake," he repeated, wincing as though in pain.
"Because I'm certain that the greater part of your irritability comes from the uncertainty of your position."
"Yes.
Now he has laid aside all pretense, and all his cold hatred for me is apparent," she thought,
not hearing his words, but watching with terror the cold, cruel judge who looked mockingly at her out of his eyes.
"The cause is not that," she said.
"And indeed, I don't see how the cause of my irritability, as you call it, can be that I am completely in your power.
What uncertainty is there in the position? On the contrary."
"I'm very sorry that you don't care to understand," he interrupted, obstinately anxious to give utterance to his thought. "The uncertainty consists in your imagining that I am free."
"On that score you can set your mind quite at rest," she said.
And turning away from him, she began drinking her coffee. She lifted her cup, with her little finger stuck out, and put it to her lips. After drinking a few sips, she glanced at him, and by his expression
she saw clearly that he was repelled by her hand and her gesture, and the sound made by her lips.
"I don't care in the least what your mother thinks, and what match she wants to make for you," she said, putting the cup down with a shaking hand.
"But we're not talking about that."
"Yes, that's just what we are talking about. And let me tell you that a heartless woman, whether she's old or not old, your mother or anyone else, is of no consequence to me, and I wouldn't consent to know her."
"Anna, I beg you not to speak disrespectfully of my mother."
"A woman whose heart doesn't tell her where her son's happiness and honour lie has no heart."
"I repeat my request that you do not speak disrespectfully of my mother, whom I respect," he said, raising his voice and looking sternly at her.
She didn't answer. Looking intently at him, at his face, his hands, she recalled all the details of their reconciliation the previous day, and his passionate caresses. "There, just such caresses he has lavished and will lavish and longs to lavish on other women," she thought.
"You don't love your mother. That's all talk and talk and talk," she said, looking at him with hatred in her eyes.
"Even if so, you must..."
"Must decide, and I have decided," she said.
And she would have gone away, but at that moment Yashvin walked into the room. Anna greeted him and remained. Why, when there was a tempest in her soul, and she felt she was standing at a turning point in her life which might have fearful consequences, why, at that minute, she had to keep up appearances before an outsider who sooner or later must know it all, she didn't know. But at once, quelling the storm within her, she sat down and began talking to their guest.
"Well, how are you getting on? Has your debt been paid you?" she asked Yashvin.
"Oh, pretty fair. I don't think I'll get it all, but I shall get a good half." "And when are you off?" said Yashvin, looking at Vronsky and unmistakably guessing at a quarrel. "The day after tomorrow, I think," said Vronsky. "You've been meaning to go so long, though."
"But now it's quite decided," said Anna,
looking Vronsky straight in the face with a look that told him not to dream of the possibility of reconciliation.
"Don't you feel sorry for that unlucky Pevtsov?" she went on, talking to Yashvin.
"I've never asked myself the question, Anna Arkadyevna, whether I'm sorry for him or not. You see, my fortune's here."
He touched his breast pocket.
"Just now I'm a wealthy man. But today I'm going to the club, and I may come out a beggar. You see, whoever sits down to play with me, he wants to leave me without a shirt on my back, and so do I him. And so we fight it out. And that's the pleasure of it."
"Well, suppose you were married," said Anna. "How would it be for your wife?"
Yashvin laughed.
"That's why I'm not married, and never mean to be."
"And Helsingfors," said Vronsky, entering into the conversation and glancing at Anna's smiling face. Meeting his eyes, Anna's face instantly took on a coldly severe expression, as though she were saying to him, "It's not forgotten. Nothing's changed."
"Were you really in love?" she said to Yashvin.
"Oh, heavens, very many times. But you see, some men can play cards, and yet always be ready to lay down their cards when the hour comes for a rendezvous, while I can have an affair, and yet never be late for my cards in the evening. That's how I manage things."
"No, I didn't mean that, but the real thing." She would have said Helsingfors, but wouldn't repeat the word used by Vronsky. Voitov, who was buying a horse from Vronsky, came in. Anna got up and went out of the room. Before leaving the house, Vronsky went into her room. She thought of pretending to look for something on the table, but ashamed of making a pretense, she looked straight into his face with cold eyes.
"What do you want?" she asked in French.
"Gambetta's pedigree. I've sold him," he said, in a tone that said more clearly than words, "I've no time for discussing things, and it would lead to nothing."
"I'm not to blame in any way," he thought. "If she will punish herself, so much the worse for her." But as he was going, he thought that she said something, and his heart suddenly ached with pity for her.
"Eh, Anna?" he queried.
"I said nothing," she answered,
just as coldly and calmly.
Oh, nothing. So much the worse for her, then, he thought, feeling indifferent again, and he turned and went out. As he was going out, he caught a glimpse of her face in the mirror, white, with quivering lips. He wanted to stop and say some comforting word to her, but his legs carried him out of the room before he could think of what to say. The whole of that day he spent away from home, and when he came in late in the evening, the maid told him that Anna Arkadyevna had a headache and begged him not to go into her. Chapter 26. Never before had a whole day been passed in quarrel. Today was the first time, and it wasn't a quarrel. It was the open acknowledgement of complete estrangement. Was it possible for him to have looked at her as he had when he came into the room for the pedigree, if it were otherwise? Look at her, see her heart was breaking with despair, and go out without a word with that face of callous indifference. He was not merely cold to her. He hated her because he loved another woman. That was clear. And remembering all the cruel words he had said, Anna supplied as well the words that he had unmistakably wished to say and could have said to her, and she grew more and more exasperated.
"I'm not holding you," he might have said. "You can go where you like. You were unwilling to be divorced from your husband, no doubt, so that you might go back to him. Go back to him. If you want money, I'll give it to you. How many roubles do you want?"
All the cruelest words that a brutal man could say, he said to her in her imagination. And she couldn't forgive him for them, as though he had actually said them. "Didn't he only yesterday swear he loved me? He, a truthful and sincere man. Haven't I despaired for nothing many times already?" she said to herself afterwards. All that day, except for the visit to Wilson's, which occupied 2 hours, Anna spent in doubts whether everything was over, or whether there was still hope of reconciliation, whether she should go away at once, or see him once more. She was expecting him the whole day, and in the evening, as she went to her own room, leaving a message for him that her head ached, she said to herself, "If he comes, in spite of what the maid says, it means that he loves me still. If not, it means that all is over. And then I will decide what I'm to do." In the evening, she heard the rumbling of his carriage stop at the entrance, his ring, his steps, and his conversation with the servant. He believed what was told him, didn't care to find out more, and went to his own room. So then everything was over. And death rose clearly and vividly before her mind as the sole means of bringing back love for her in his heart, of punishing him, and of gaining the victory in that strife which the evil spirit in possession of her heart was waging with him. Now nothing mattered, going or not going to Vodvizhenskoye, getting or not getting a divorce from her husband. All that didn't matter. The one thing that mattered was punishing him. When she poured out her usual dose of opium, and thought that she had only to drink off the whole bottle to die, it seemed to her so simple and easy that she began musing with enjoyment on how he would suffer and repent, and love her memory when it would be too late. She lay in bed with open eyes, by the light of a single burned-down candle, gazing at the carved cornice of the ceiling and at the shadow of the screen that covered part of it, while she vividly pictured to herself how he would feel when she would be no more, when she would be only a memory to him.
"How could I say such cruel things to her?" he would say. "How could I go out of the room without saying anything to her? But now she's no more. She's gone away from us forever. She is..."
Suddenly, the shadow of the screen wavered, pounced on the whole cornice, the whole ceiling.
Other shadows from the other side swooped to meet it.
For an instant the shadows flitted back, but then with fresh swiftness they darted forward, wavered, mingled, and all was darkness. "Death," she thought. And such horror came upon her that for a long time she couldn't realize where she was, and for a long while her trembling hands couldn't find the matches and light another candle, instead of the one that had burned down and gone out. "No, anything, only to live. Why, I love him. Why, he loves me.
"This has been before, and will pass," she said, feeling that tears of joy at the return to life were trickling down her cheeks. And to escape from her panic, she went hurriedly to his room. He was asleep there, and sleeping soundly. She went up to him, and holding the light above his face, she gazed a long while at him. Now, when he was asleep, she loved him so much that at the sight of him she couldn't keep back tears of tenderness. But she knew that if he awakened, he would look at her with cold eyes, convinced that he was right. And that before telling him of her love, she would have to prove to him that he had been wrong in his treatment of her. Without waking him, she went back, and after a second dose of opium toward morning, she fell into a heavy, incomplete sleep, during which she never quite lost consciousness. In the morning, she was awakened by a horrible nightmare, which had reoccurred several times in her dreams, even before her liaison with Vronsky. A little old man with unkempt beard was doing something, bent down over some iron, muttering meaningless French words, and she, as she always did in this nightmare, it was what made it so horrible, felt that this peasant was taking no notice of her, but was doing something horrible with the iron over her. And she awoke in a cold sweat. When she got up, the previous day came back to her as though veiled in mist. There was a quarrel, just what has happened several times. I said I had a headache, and he didn't come in to see me. Tomorrow we're going away. I must see him and get ready for the journey, she said to herself. And learning that he was in his study, she went down to him. As she passed through the drawing-room, she heard a carriage stop at the entrance, and looking out of the window, she saw the carriage. A young girl in a lilac hat was leaning out, giving some direction to the footman ringing the bell. After a parley in the hall, someone came upstairs, and Vronsky's steps could be heard passing the drawing-room. He went rapidly downstairs. Anna went again to the window. She saw him come out onto the steps without his hat and go up to the carriage. The young girl in the lilac hat handed him a parcel. Vronsky, smiling, said something to her. The carriage drove away, and he ran rapidly upstairs again. The mists that had shrouded everything in her soul parted suddenly. The feelings of yesterday pierced the sick heart with a fresh pang. She couldn't understand now how she could have lowered herself by spending a whole day with him in his house. She went into his room to announce her determination.
That was Madame Sorokina and her daughter. They came and brought me the money and the documents from Maman. I couldn't get them yesterday.
How is your head? Better, he said quietly, not wishing to see and to understand the gloomy and solemn expression of her face. She looked silently, intently at him, standing in the middle of the room. He glanced at her, frowned for a moment, and went on reading a letter. She turned and went deliberately out of the room. He still could have called her back, but she had reached the door. He was still silent, and the only sound audible was the rustling of the paper as he turned it over.
"Oh, by the way," he said, at the very moment she was in the doorway. "We are going tomorrow for certain, aren't we?"
"You, but not I," she said, turning around.
"Anna, we can't go on like this."
"You, but not I," she repeated.
"This is getting unbearable."
"You'll be sorry for this," she said, and went out. Frightened by the desperate expression with which these words were uttered, he jumped up with the intention of running after her. But on second thoughts, he sat down and scowled, clenching his teeth. This vulgar, as he thought it, threat of something vague exasperated him. "I've tried everything," he thought. "The only thing left is not to pay attention." And he began to get ready to drive into town and again to his mother's to get her signature to the power of attorney. She heard the sound of his steps about the study and the dining room. At the drawing room he stood still. But he didn't come in to see her. He merely gave an order that the horse should be given to Voitov if he came while he was away. Then she heard the carriage brought round, the door opened, and he came out again. But he went back into the porch again, and someone was running upstairs. It was the valet running up for his gloves that had been forgotten. She went to the window and saw him take the gloves without looking, and touching the coachman on the back, he said something to him. Then, without looking up at the window, he settled himself in his usual attitude in the carriage, and with his legs crossed and pulling on a glove, he vanished around the corner.